Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop on this Thursday, May 25th. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us for the gardening program today, gardener Greg Ward of Ward's Nursery and arborist Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum. And we welcome your gardening calls right now. We'll get you in the queue. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. Or you may email the program voxpop@wamc.org. If you are a regular listener to the gardening show, you know it is a popular one. Always best to get in line early. 800-348-2551. Your gardening questions coming up after the news. Okay, the time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop on this Thursday, May 25th. I'm Ray Graff. Well, today is the gardening show. We've been talking fishing during the break, and now we have to think about gardening. Gardener Greg Ward of Ward's Nursery is here, and arborist Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum is here, and we welcome your gardening calls right now at 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Now, you know it's a popular program. And now that spring is in full swing, many people will be calling with their questions about the planting season, et cetera, et cetera. So call early, 800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. So it's time to talk gardening, and we welcome back Fred and Greg. How you doing, guys?
Hey, it's good to be back.
Really well, really well.
I got to say, Greg, I see the sticker on your shirt. It says, celebrating 60 years, Ward's Nursery, where gardeners grow. It's very nice.
Thank you very much.
Now, 60 years ago, it was a smaller operation when you founded it?
Yeah, it was. It's actually got history before that. In 1957, my dad purchased the property. It had been a garden center for a couple of decades before that, since 1932.
Wow, cool.
A gentleman named Warren Dolby had it as a garden center. Before that, it was a girls' school, apparently. Anyway, it's the old field. The old fields are where the garden center then became.
So cool. And so you were a little kid, and did you always know you had the bug for it?
I thought I didn't have the bug, though it was a regular summer job, weekend job throughout high school. I would say somewhere after that, maybe early 20s, that's when it suddenly hit me.
Well, congrats on the 60th anniversary of Ward's. And Fred Breglia, that's one nice trout. We saw your picture on Facebook. That's impressive. Where'd you catch that?
I'd rather not say on the air where that was caught. But I'll tell you offline.
Oh, really?
I'll tell you offline.
Okay.
Right. It is quite beautiful.
Yeah, it's a beautiful trout.
Very impressive.
Big brown trout. So it was best of the year for me so far.
Congrats. So, and all right, well, let's get right to the phones at 800-348-2551. And we begin with Barbara in Grafton. Barbara, you're on.
Holy smokes, I'm number one. Woohoo!
Numero uno.
Hey, my gardening style could be best described as poke and hope. Okay. I mean, I read the labels and I put things where they should go and I do what it says. And then I just say, well, good luck. Now, this year I had planted 4 vinca plants last year and then I mulched around them. And now that I'm reading, they're supposed to spread their trailers under the soil to pop up elsewhere.
That's correct. Yep.
But I have some that are sending trailers over the top of everything and popping up elsewhere.
They'll do that as well.
The trailers?
Actually, you could leave them. You could leave them alone. They'll spread out the foliage and cover a lot of area that way. They'll also spread out with their roots, and you'll see new little plants come up sort of around the mother clump as well. It's a really great plant that does cover a lot of hard to otherwise cover spots. And tolerates an incredible amount of abuse and everything from shade to even sun with that plant. It seems to do really well.
The mulch is, it's sort of a catch-22, but it's something you want to do because you don't want other things to germinate and get in the way of the vinca. But once it starts to fill in, you won't need to mulch them again.
That's right.
There you go.
And I had part two was butterfly bush.
Okay.
I had given up hope on mine, and finally I saw a couple of green leaves. Now, I had not cut off all of the twigs that are coming up out of it from last season because I don't know what is alive and what is dead.
Well, yeah. What we tell people about butterfly bush is you can kind of scratch it with your fingernail or a knife or a little pruner. Just scratch the wood on the branches that look kind of dead. And if you see green, mm-hmm. leave them alone. And if you see brown, they're dead. And what you want to do is find a place where the brown meets the green. And on some winters, that'll be all the way to the ground. And then other years, you'll see that green kind of come up off of the ground quite a bit. In our zone, it's very known that those plants will die back, but their roots are very hardy and they'll continue to grow and produce flowers for you every year. It does really well. If you're in a more, warmer zone like downstate, butterfly bush often does not die back and can be 5, 6, 7 feet.
Oh yeah, they can get big. It has been cool. The weather has been cool so far. The soil still until recently been cool. So the plant, may still be getting ready to grow. So you definitely don't need to rush pruning. As Fred said, though, if it's dry wood now, yes, certainly remove it.
Okay.
Okay, and yeah, it's because we must have had a bad winter here. It's the only growth I'm seeing at all at is from the very bottom of the bush.
Yeah, and that's kind of common for butterfly bush. Again, in our area, the Northeast, especially upstate New York and zones 5 or even colder, you're going to see that dieback occur. So even with a good winter, you often see the dieback head down a stem and very close to the base. But warmer zones, like I said, you'll get those to go through really good. Either way, it's going to do really well for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we recommend in the late fall, November, doing what we call as a winter mulch. And usually when you winter mulch something, you often use soil or compost.
Yeah.
And you mound it about a foot high. So you're burying the plant, the crown of the plant, about a foot. You don't do any pruning. You leave all the stems sticking out. And that insulates more of that base, more of the wood at the bottom that will hopefully allow it to survive.
All right, Barbara, we appreciate the call. Our number here on Vox Pop is 800-348-2551, The Gardening Show with Fred Breglia and Greg Ward. And let's go to Carrie in Plainfield, Mass. Carrie, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Yeah, I got two quick questions for your guests.
Okay.
First question, I have rather large window flower boxes, and I fill it with a 50-50 compost soil mix. And I put various annuals into those flower boxes. And also, I like to put the cascading plants, either vinca or the potato plant, into it. But those cascading plants just never seem to grow like I've seen others. They don't seem to have the foliage, and they don't cascade like they should. Is there something I'm doing wrong? Should I add Miracle-Gro or something of that type into it?
Well, you should certainly fertilize any of the things that are in planter boxes because it's different than soil. And even things in soil will benefit from supplemental fertilization. But in flower boxes and also any kind of containers, patio containers, deck containers, the plants are really 100% dependent on you for the food. And most of the time, the potting mixes, unless you get one that has a low or slow release fertilizer in it, which often is available, many of them don't have any nutrition at all. And they're, and in fact, the kind I prefer are just neutral. They don't have anything because I like to be able to put exactly what kind of fertilizer I want them. And soluble fertilizers work really, really well for flower boxes and containers.
I would, as you're potting, putting the boxes together with the soil, just work in some fertilizer, something dry and granular that we often recommend plant tone for things. That would be a great thing. Just work it in now before you plant. You can do it afterwards, but if you do it now, that should get you going well into July, and then you may want to do it a second time then.
All right, Carrie, you had a second question?
Yeah, second question. Okay, I live in Massachusetts. And I understand that they sell a so-called special marijuana soil. And I was wondering, is there really anything special about that soil?
I have no idea, but I do know what you mean. We have increased the number of brands of soil that we sell at the Garden Center, and I think that may be one of the major reasons why.
How do you like that?
Yeah, it's interesting. But they all are compost-based, peat compost-based soils, often with a little bit of perlite in them. I don't personally think that they have a big difference. There's a big difference between them and any other compost-based soil.
All right, Carrie, thanks a lot for that interesting question. Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Gardening Show. Greg Ward, Fred Breglia here, and Dennis in Greenfield is next. Dennis.
Oh, hi there. Hello.
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 Hi there. Yeah, my name's Dennis. Thank you for taking my call. And in our front garden, we have liverwort. It's like almost like an algae-type plant, and it spreads like moss. And when we try to just remove it by hand, it we're pulling up a lot of good dirt with it. And it just sort of covers everything. It seems to smother other things, too. Is there any way to get rid of it? When we had moss in our lawn, we inadvertently killed a lot of moss by putting 10-10-10 fertilizer. Just broadcast it. It seemed to kill the moss. I like moss, but would I be able to put granular fertilizer on the liverwort, or is there some other thing? Maybe there's the way the soil is set up. It's just, it's not wonderful soil anyway, but we do grow a lot of variety of plants in it. It's just in our front garden.
You know, the liverwort is there because your soil is probably it's bare, it's compacted in those areas, and probably, as you just said, not ideal. Not a lot of compost in there, not a lot of activity. So a heavier clay soil, for the same reason it was growing moss, can often grow liverworts. I don't think the fertilizer is the way to go. I would amend the soil. I would consider mulching the area so you're actually covering those areas that the liverwort is growing. That may be effective.
Yeah, it might be a pH thing too. If you change the pH a little bit on the soil.
Would I have to sample it or send it off to get sampled something?
Yeah, the best thing would be to take it to, a local cooperative extension. They could do a pH test on your soil. And you want to do a randomized sample?
And they could explain.
They
could explain to me how to do that if we just take it from areas.
Yeah, what do you mean randomized?
Yeah, when I say randomized, if you're looking for, let's just say, the area of this room, which is a pretty small area to be sampling,
8 by 10.
I would still take a half dozen at least different samples from varying depths and different areas, that corner, this corner.
Do you have to mark where you're there from?
No, you just want to make sure you take
you mix them
good,
together.
You're going to make a mix out of the samples.
Oh, I see.
And you shake it up really good so that sample, instead of just getting a pH out of one little pocket where something might have broken down and given you a false reading, you're going to get a much more accurate number if you can get a more accurate randomized sample. So, and the cooperative extensions will typically tell you that, but the pH test is only as good as the sample you give them.
Dennis, thanks for the call. We'll take a break here. It's The Gardening Show, 800-348-2551, the number. Greg Ward, Fred Breglia here, you there, and the calls come back after we come back.
Support for WAMC comes from Basin Harbor, Lake Champlain, Vermont. Lakefront accommodations for vacations, weddings, and conferences, featuring a championship golf course and new boat club with 40 slips for overnight stays. BasinHarbor.com for details. Shannon Rose Design, Saratoga Springs, New York. Working to help companies and organizations express their identities through corporate branding, web design and development, and graphic design for almost 3 decades. ShannonRose.com. Adams Ferriker Farms, Poughkeepsie, Kingston, Newburgh, and Wappinger. Fresh seafood, Hereford beef, farm fresh produce, local and imported cheeses, specialty groceries, AdamsFarms.com. Whitney's Farm Market and Country Gardens, Cheshire. Featuring the We Plan, You Plant garden design service with on-site selection of nursery stock, tree, shrub, perennial, garden, privacy hedges, installation, WhitneysFarm.com. And Agricultural Stewardship Association, helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever. agstewardship.org.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you, along with Fred Breglia and Greg Ward. It's The Gardening Show. Our phone number is 800-348-2551. Now, you can also email the program, and we try to get through as many of those as possible. Not always possible to get through all of the calls or emails, but here are a few emails that came in. This one's from Donna. It's all about lilies of the valley. She says, mine bloomed for 23 years. This year, the plants came up, but they didn't bloom. What gives? And that's from Donna.
That's interesting because they're really blooming very well this year in pretty much everywhere I've looked. I would have to say that last year's drought stressed them to the point where they were not able to set those flower buds.
Okay, and they may come back next year?
Oh, and if the leaves are
almost
up.
Almost guaranteed if the leaves are up.
Yeah, if the leaves are up and they're going, I would fertilize them. Yep. But other than that, I'd say this year should take care of them and bring them back.
All right, this one is from Andrew, who writes, what is the best type of climbing plant to use on the exterior of a brick building? Full sun until noon, flowers would be great. Thank you. That's from Andrew.
Well,
go ahead.
I was going to say Boston Ivy has been one that certainly has worked for Harvard University and Arnold Arboretum. They have built entire buildings covered with it. The good thing about those type of plants is that certain vines will actually penetrate the brick and actually destroy homes. So if you put the wrong vine on your house, it could be a problem. But Boston Ivy, hence the name Boston and Harvard University, it has little suction cups that just adhere to the outside surface of the brick, and you could actually pull them off pretty easily.
But they leave marks. I know.
Maybe little marks.
My house had it was covered. Okay. The front of it, it's a slate front, was covered in it when we bought it.
All right.
And it was decided, not necessarily by me, that the vines had to go.
Okay.
And so my brother and I had a hell of a time getting all those vines.
But you got your brother to help you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's thick.
Yeah. And it didn't have any damage to the structure, right? It's just a little coloration.
Well, on my house, you really can't tell.
Okay. But that would be certainly one.
So Boston Ivy and Virginia Creeper, closely related native plant, will adhere to the brick without any kind of trellis. The other plant that can do that is a hydrangea vine.
Wow. Ah.
And that does flower. So that would be probably the one that would adhere that would have a flower. Otherwise, you'd have to build some structure for everything else. And then there's several, honeysuckle, clematis, etc.
This one came in from Aaron. Last year, I planted a dogwood in a hole that is close to a large root from a nearby maple tree. The dogwood didn't survive. This year, I planted another dogwood in the same hole. I don't think this one is going to make it. Is it too close to that root? Does that maple tree send out some evil juju so that the dogwood doesn't thrive? That's what my wife thinks. Is there any truth to this theory? Should I have left the burlap on the root ball when I planted it? It came apart when I took the burlap off, and I wonder if that affected the health of the new tree.
Well, he answered the question right there. If you take the burlap off, which is recommended by the International Society of Arboriculture in those cages, but the caveat here is if you take it apart and you break the ball, you should have left it all on. If you break the ball, you've destroyed the plant and almost guaranteed it won't grow.
It's interesting. So if the tree is not leafed out yet, if it's still dormant and the ball breaks apart, it's like planting a bare root tree. And
it's fine.
There is a usually a great survivability, but
the
tree has just leafed out, which has happened to most trees, and then the ball breaks, the fine root hairs that formed the same time that the leaves came out tear, and that stresses the tree, plus the stress of having to keep those leaves alive. I wouldn't give up, though. I would keep it well-watered, staked so that it doesn't wiggle, so the trunk doesn't wiggle, and then see what happens.
Now, what about the proximity to the maple?
Not an issue.
Okay.
One root of a maple tree, the roots of most trees coexist anyways, so even if you planted it further away, the roots would all be fused together no matter what. The roots of the trees typically grow out 2 to 3 times the canopy spread. So we're talking about a really big, flat pancake. They don't go down real deep. They go down about 12 to 15 inches, but they grow out 3 times the canopy spread.
So Aaron's issue is a root ball issue.
And if anything, is good juju.
Yeah, if anything, it's good juju. But I would say it's a planting issue, and there are ways to get the burlap and the metal off of the ball without breaking it. There's a few tricks, but the main thing is never dig a hole deeper than you need to. Always dig a hole twice as wide as the ball that you're putting in the ground. Never open the ball or attempt to remove any metal until you actually have the tree in the hole and situated exactly as you want it, facing the side that you want, turned and straight and all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And only at that point do I begin to try to cut that material off. And I use a cheap pair of bolt cutters to remove the galvanized metal because the wire cutters are really hard to get through.
All right.
Cutters work well.
We have so many calls. Let's try to get back to them now. I know we have Elaine on line 3 who we lost her connection and she's back. Elaine, you're on the road and you're on.
Hi. Gentlemen, I'm a graduate of the Institute for Ecosystem Studies, and I am befuddled as to why this problem happened to the entire street where we live. Our street is shaded in trees, and last year I noticed that all people have planted pachysandra and shade-growing plants along the roadways on both sides of the road. And for a significant amount of footage from the road back toward the homes, and we must have, and the average is probably 300 feet back from the street, the pachysandra is dead, whereas the pachysandra is thriving from, 300 feet back toward people's homes. Mm-hmm. And I have a theory, and I'm wondering what your opinion might be.
Okay.
And I have talked to people in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. I have talked to people in California. I have talked to people in Utah. I have talked to people in the Philippines who observed that contrails in the atmosphere. And one, I have credit cards. And, when you talk to the credit card support people or agents, you have opportunities to talk with them. And one of them in the Philippines noticed that her uncle, who was a rice grower, found that the rice grains, when they were taken off the stem, just pulverized in the hands.
Okay.
And she attributed it to the contrails.
All right.
And was wondering whether or not the atmosphere is being sprayed with something.
I see. Well,
and I am wondering whether or not our atmosphere has been sprayed with something. And I wonder if anything, if this is related to the Fukushima nuclear explosion.
Okay.
Meltdown.
I'm not sure
that
Fred and Greg can answer this question, but about the pachysandra, that's something you may be able to touch upon.
If it's from the road in toward the houses, the first thing we probably thought about is salt damage.
Yep, that's the
road
first
salt.
That's the first thing we thought about.
Okay.
Whether or not the salt would be in that zone at all, where the dead is. That's question number one for you.
Snow load in general can also affect pachysandra.
Okay.
So do you notice the damage to be sort of in conjunction with where?
The thing about it is we live on a rural street. And it's not like a major highway or anything. And if they sprayed any saline solution, there's no way in the world that it could have reached back 300 feet into people's property.
Well, so they're not plowing snow. They're not plowing any snow where onto the areas where the pachysandra are dead. Correct?
Or are they?
No.
Okay.
They're not. Okay.
Absolutely
all right.
Not.
All right. So then we would rule out the salt. Another issue with pachysandra is that they do sometimes develop stem cankers.
Yep.
And then if it's been brewing for a while, stem cankers can kind of run rampant and kill large patches. And just because it's healthy in one area and it's dead in the other, it might be making its way
through the whole
patch.
Oh,
and you would notice this because it's not a real hard one to find. You'd look at the plants that are on the edge of where the death and the live occur. So you get that middle zone. Look for that line. And then you would need to use probably a hand lens, but you could see it with your naked eye. You would see little dark sort of spots on the stems.
Okay.
And those would be cankers, fungal problem. And it's quite common on pachysandra in certain cases.
Okay. Greg?
No, those are the only things we could come up with, I'd say.
All right. Thank you for that call. We appreciate it. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Rick in Claverick. Rick, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling in regards to beefsteak tomatoes. Growing up, my dad always grew these big, beautiful beefsteak tomatoes. And I'm in my 50s now, and I grow decent tomatoes, but nothing like my dad used to. And I know he used to use Miracle-Gro periodically or whatever. My wife has horses, of which we have all different stages of years of horse manure. And I'm just wondering, what is the secret to growing an old-fashioned beefsteak tomato?
One of the things is, I don't know if you're using – well, one thing is the seed source. Genetics are a role. They play a large role in fruit development. So the first thing I would say, are you sure you're using a similar seed to your dad? Because he might have been using...
Well, I have noticed different times where a lot of times I buy the plants ahead of time and they say beefsteaks and sometimes they don't come out as beefsteaks.
Yep, which is possible.
But I have been dealing with an organic grower just down the road from me.
Okay.
And he says they're like the traditional old-fashioned beefsteaks.
Okay, so yeah. So genetics are part of it, and then the other part of it is the grower. Now, your dad might have had a little bit of a knack for keeping the plant from undergoing any for getting through any stress. One of the things that tomatoes like are really uniform watering. So if they experience drought, it will even if you experience drought be to the point where they don't even wilt, we're talking just they get dry. They like a nice constant sort of moisture. They don't want to be wet, and they don't like the foliage wet. You want to make sure you're doing bottom watering so that you're not watering all the leaves. But constant watering is a big part of it. Fertilizing is another part of it. And you mentioned manures. If the manures are really rotten, it's really good. Fresh manures you got to be careful with.
Why?
Well, you could burn the plant, but more common than that, you're getting so much nitrogen as opposed to phosphorus and potassium. Phosphorus, potassium are a big part of the fruit set, whereas opposed to the nitrogen is going to make more of a leafier plant with often smaller size fruit. So water and proper nutrition is a big part of it.
And of course, you have a nice sunny location there.
Yeah, I have full sun from morning until just about dark.
The horse manure, as Fred said, should be well rotted. There, you know, may be some issues with this. Horse manure tends to be more acidic, is what's told. So you don't want to be using that exclusively as the nutrient source. You may want to be just adding 10-15% into the garden soil every year, and then adding a complete fertilizer in addition to that.
What type of fertilizer?
I said complete. That just means a fertilizer that has nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium in it,
as well as all the trace elements and micronutrients. And complete would have all of that.
Rotating the location of the plants is always helpful. So that every 3 years you come back to the original location. So putting them in the same place every year can diminish the quality.
Yep. Rick, thank you.
The only thing I'd say is check your pH as well, the local cooperative.
You know, is there not a simple kit that you can test your own pH?
There is. Yeah, there's some pretty simple
It's not very
kits.
Difficult, is it?
It's not.
We have little pH kits. They're basically like the litmus kits that you had in chemistry class.
Yeah, I remember
that. They exist.
Yep, you drop a couple of drops, it changes color, you look at a chart. There are also electronic ones, too.
You have to use distilled water. Just keep that in mind.
Okay, fair enough. Let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. Shelly in Cheshire. Shelly, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Can you turn your radio down just a little bit, Shelly?
Yes, I just turned it off.
Okay, beautiful. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I have a problem, and I've had it for years. I inadvertently bought some anemones, you know, those white flowers that bloom at the end of April, in June.
Yes.
Yep. And I don't know whether anemone, like the god of the wind, blew over to my vegetable and perennial garden, but they've just taken over the garden. I've dug it up last fall, and had it rototilled, and these roots seem to go like spider webs everywhere. Do you have anything that I can do? Any advice you can give me to let me to have an anemone-free garden?
So the anemone I believe you're talking about is either Sylvestris or Canadensis. These are very pleasant white flowers. They grow about 2 feet tall, but they are aggressive. They will grow quite rampantly. Since your garden was rototilled last fall, whatever is popping up in the garden should be easy to get out right now. And that would be my first recommendation, is to go out there with your digging fork or whatever implement you
pull them out,
like to use, and work the roots right out of the ground, make a nice pile, and get it to the compost.
You can't just cut them and...
No, because
a lot of the energy is in the roots. So if you cut the top off, it's going to keep resprouting and resprouting.
So it's not like one of those where you just keep cutting it over and over again?
That works really well for woody plants.
Ah, very interesting.
Where so much of the stem has energy, and then it'll send a lot of that energy down to the roots, and then it sends it back up and it uses it up. Woody plants are a little different than perennials.
I think it's about persistence now. Once you think you've gotten it out and you plant this, you know, just if you're out there weekly, just sort of popping them out here and there, that should do it.
Shelley, thank you. Our number is 800-348-2551. Let's go over to Russ in Waterford. Russ.
Hello there. I have a couple of questions. I'm afraid my first one probably pales in comparison to some of these gardening questions. Is there anything that neutralizes dog urine spots on my lawn?
The old dog urine question.
Again, that is an acidity issue. I don't know. I think there's some products out there that say they work for that. But how do you know it's going to be a spot until it is a spot?
It's pH that's issue, true. Right?
Is it?
Yeah, it is.
So
it
can
is.
You put it's lime on or something?
That's a theory. You know, you could definitely alkalize it a little bit, and that should help.
Once have that dead area, taking up that sod, irrigating heavily to dilute whatever is what's ever left there, and reseeding is, I think, the only choice I can recommend.
Oh boy,
it can be a real problem.
I'd heard somebody say a lime slurry might work, but I mean, the only thing that I've done that works is tearing it up and putting soil down and reseeding it.
Yep. What is the pH of dog urine, gentlemen?
You know, I'm not sure. We're definitely talking acidic, though.
And I forget which one sex is more acidic than the other.
That's right. We've had this conversation.
I cannot remember which one is which.
It just shows you how pathetic this show can be. We've actually talked about this before.
Maybe Russ. But I do think that the lime would theoretically help the lawn no matter what, because lawn likes more of an alkaline soil, and acidic soil tends to yield more mosses and things like that.
That's true. And if you lime your lawn as whatever the general recommendation is, you know, 5 pounds per 100 square feet, that lime, while it's there, may help neutralize a future.
That's kind of what I'm thinking.
All right, Russ, do you have a non-urine related question for us?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I've been affected by this red lily beetle.
Yep.
And I other than I pick them off and crush them, is there something I can spray on them?
We got a couple of choices. The any general purpose plant insecticide that, you know, something that says for roses and flowers, something that says for vegetables, if it's about killing an insect, will kill those beetles. The organic solution out there that we have been recommending is any product that has a thing called spinosad in it.
Okay.
And
somebody said something about neem oil, and I didn't know
is another possible solution. It's an organic solution. We've found the spinosad to be most effective.
Yep.
These things are horrible. Boy, they are. They will kill your lilies in a heartbeat.
And they're out in force this year, it seems like, too.
Yeah.
Why are they out in force this year? Do we know?
You know, it might have just been the fact that we've had some good snow cover and a lot of the egg masses where they're laid and got protected and sheltered. And there was no extreme, you know, we had a lot of snow. We had a decent winter, but not a lot of that really like 20 below zero temperatures. And that's when you hear about insects getting killed due to temperatures. It's usually not the zero that's getting them.
Okay.
It's the 20 below for multiple days. That starts to wipe out a lot of the egg masses, and you'll see a lot of less problems.
It's the Gardening Show. Fred Breglia, Greg Ward are here, and you there at 800-348-2551. Okay, the home stretch is straight ahead.
Support for WAMC comes from Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. Real Seafood Company, Wolf Road Colony, locally owned seafood restaurant and raw bar, realseafoodco.com. The Hyde Collection, an art museum and historic house in Glens Falls, New York, open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, and Sunday, 12 to 5, hydecollection.org. And Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quarry and fabrication, used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires. AshfieldStone.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you and Greg Ward and Fred Breglia. And I tell you what, gentlemen, let's take care of a couple of quick emails and then back to the phones. The lines are really loaded here, so we'll move quickly on the email. This one's from Mark. You hear people having either a vegetable garden or a garden of flowers, but never both in the same garden. Why is that? Is there some secret reason why the two cannot be combined in the same garden?
Actually, the trend of more recent times is actually blending the two together.
Really?
In fact, we're doing that this year. We're yanking some perennials out, moving them to another area, and actually installing vegetables in there. And they will do good together. It's not a problem.
It's really it's an aesthetic thing.
It's an aesthetic thing.
Architectural thing. You can do whatever you want. Okay. That's the great thing about gardening. Annuals typically are mixed in with vegetables. So if you have a vegetable garden, established vegetable garden, you're turning over those spots every year, and so putting some annuals in there is easy. To put in a perennial means, oh, it's always going to be there. But you know, some of your herbs are perennials. Your sorrel might be perennial, your thyme, your sage. Mm-hmm. So those are technically perennial flowering plants. You just happen to use them.
And they have culinary aspects. And we say more recent years, but actually it has been more of a trend in recent years to incorporate that. But if you go back far enough, colonial times and federal period plantings, they would often very much call kitchen gardens, and they would have ornamentals in there. They would also have, as Greg said, culinary herbs in there, and they would also put a lot of times produce in there.
I wonder, is it an old wives' tale? At times when we've had a garden, my wife, not that my wife is old, mind you, honey, but she said there were certain flowers that would keep certain pests away.
That's correct. Marigolds are the old fashioned.
Other chrysanthemum like plants are often used in the garden. Allium does a similar thing. Permaculture is that newish idea. I don't know if it's new, but reestablished idea that where you're growing, everything you grow in your yard is edible. And so many of those things are perennial.
I'll be darned. All right, this one came in from Dawn. I have tried several local purveyors but find a lot of wood in the compost I've delivered. I live in the Skodak area. I have 5 large raised beds where I grow vegetables. Is there anywhere I can find good compost short of making it myself? And that's from Dawn.
I don't know where Skodak is. A lot of people use wood, but I would find some fellows that use leaf mold. Where is Skodak?
It's over in Rensselaer County, I believe, or Washington County, somewhere over on the across the river from here.
Yeah, I mean, there's got to be a good compost supplier in that area. Okay. I mean, if we got one in our town, there's got to be one in your town. Our town is really small.
This is this one's from Ann and Adams. I bought a little magnolia, Ann, last year. I have been looking every day for buds, but there's not a bud, hint of a bud, leaf, nothing. I scratch the limbs, don't see any green underneath, so I'm wondering if I should be patient or if it's dead. And that's from Ann and Adams.
At this point, there should be at least some green under that bark she scratched, and yes, there should be a few leaves coming up on it. So it sounds dead.
Sorry, Ann. Yep. Sorry for your loss. This is from Ron in Kingston. I would like to move my hydrangea from northern exposure to eastern exposure. Best time to do that? Any other recommendations? And that's from Ron in Kingston.
I had actually written down here in my notes of things to talk about, and planting and transplanting was on the top of the list. And the weather, especially this weekend with this cooler weather, weekend, meaning actually today, tomorrow, is really perfect for transplanting. So if this thing isn't too big and you can manage to move it, I would do it now.
All right, we have to. There are some people who have been very patient. Ellen Newpaltz has been very, very patient. You're on, Ellen.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. The most important one for me is whether you guys could recommend a book for identifying plants. I moved into this house a few months ago, and all sorts of things are coming up, and there's some very beautiful plants. So I don't want to pull something out as weeds.
So it's not just the native plants in the woods and in the meadows. We're talking about landscapes.
No, this is a garden. These were planted, you know.
Okay. Well, there's 2 books that I've used for years for garden plants, not native material, although a lot of the natives are in there too. For woody plants, uh-huh. The go-to has always been the Manual of Woody Landscape Plants by Michael Dirr. And I absolutely love
Michael who?
D-I-R-R, Michael Dirr. And it's an incredible reference book. And it's really very well written. Gives great descriptions. Okay. And then really great to see the guy if you ever get a chance to. Just a fantastic author. But also there's another one called Manual of Herbaceous Plants by, I believe, the author is Stephen Stills.
Stills?
I believe. Not related to the infamous Stephen Stills.
Okay, not the same guy.
That's right. No, but same name, I believe. And Manual of...
Stills, S-T-I-L-L-S?
I believe so. It might be S-T-I-L-L-S. HLS, possibly. Possibly.
And I would actually recommend another. Every day, someone brings me in a baggie full of stems at the garden center to identify myself or several of the people who work with us. And that works out really well. And I know in New Paltz, there are a couple of garden centers close by. I can't think of what they're called.
Good point.
And so if you did want to, you know, snip off samples, especially if they're showing some flower, but they don't always have to be. They don't have to be. If they have some reasonable amount of stem, cut that off, label it number one, and take it to the garden center.
Great sense. Yep. Ellen, thank you for that one. Let's go quickly over to Greg in Rosendale. Greg, you're on.
Hi. I've been growing two apple trees, or trying to. They do well as far as greenery goes. I've got a Honeycrisp and a crab apple, and I've gotten some blossoms and even some apples on the crab apple, but I have never gotten a blossom on the Honeycrisp. And they're close enough to be in the same environment, but far enough apart, and I'm trying to figure out what to do.
Yeah, you know, there's probably two main reasons why that would occur. The main one, number one, would be that the Honeycrisp flowers are marginal in your planting zone, which means that the winter temperatures damage the flower buds, or even the spring temperatures when it's cold. But the foliage buds are always hardier than the flower buds, in which case you have great foliage, but very little fruit set or flowers, because those get damaged every year. And it just could be even a microclimate, even if they are working in your area, but you get a little extra wind in your spot. That could also be enough to damage those. The other reason would be a fertility thing, which is certainly less common, because if it was fertility, you would see some flowers.
And these trees you've had for a few years or 1 year, how long have they been there?
Probably I've had them for, this is the fourth year, so so it's 3 years without
One flower. You have not seen a flower on this plant.
And, not one.
And it's growing vigorously.
It's growing well. I give it tree tone twice a year, and it's never had any problems with drought. I've kept it well watered, but not over.
And it's a nice sunny spot.
Yeah, it could probably use more sun.
I mean, usually what we have found is a little bit of structural pruning will, you know, be, and that could be summer pruning now.
It can be.
That would help set, that would be this month coming, June pruning, to help set up, you know, a little bit of stress for flower bud set, and then, you know, light can affect them certainly, but I think it should flower for you. Okay. But 4 years is a long time.
All right, Greg, thank you very much. Over to line eight, and Ellen in Monterey, Mass. Ellen, you're on.
Hi, thanks. We have an old 1740 farmhouse in Monterey on a number of acres, and for 20 years, I've been working on a garden, a flower garden that I love, but in the past 10 years, I have goutweed. I am going out of my mind trying to get rid of it. What can I do?
That is a tough guy. That's the bane of many gardeners, the old goutweed. Hand-pulling persistence and a lot of work with that does reduce that quite dramatically, but you really have to get those little fibrous little roots and get those out, because if you leave those little stems, they will pop up. Smothering.
That's what's happening. But I do snap off the leaves every time I see them, and that's okay to do? That's one way to deal with it?
Yeah, just keep on, you know, taking its leaves away. It's not as effective as it is with woody plants, but it does work. It wears it down. Smothering also can work if you have black plastic and can just pin down sections of it so that temporarily where it would get smothered.
Is it incorporated in your perennial border, and that's where you're dealing with it?
There, it's a circular garden, and it's just going through the
so you have
area of the circle.
You have
and
things in there.
Up in between the leaves of the daylilies so, and the iris. So I'm afraid to try to dig it because I'm afraid I'll damage the plant.
So the other option is to renovate that garden. Yep. If it's iris and daylilies primarily, that's a great thing to do late July, August. You would actually take everything up, and in doing so, find all of the roots of the goutweed, and then replant when you know it's clean.
All right, quickly, you had a second question, Ellen, and then we have to move on.
Okay, aphids on the lupine without using a chemical pesticide.
Insecticidal soap works really, really well.
Insecticidal soap.
Yep, and not a chemical. Every garden center will carry it. You can kind of, look online and probably find some natural soaps that would kind of work.
Doing some damage, you could even ignore them unless they're doing some.
And when I get rid of them on lupins, if they'll cluster to stems, I actually like rip them, kind of like squash them all in the process of kind of getting them off, and then I hit it with insecticidal soap.
All right, over to Jim in North Pownell. Jim.
Hi, I've got a question about hybrid chestnut trees. I planted two of them approximately 25 years ago, and one of them is absolutely beautiful. It's about 30 feet tall. It's got about a 30-foot spread. And the other one, which is only about 50 feet away, is sporadic. It comes in, and then it dies back. And then it comes in, and then it dies back. And I was just wondering, should I get rid of it and plant another one for cross-pollination, or should I just keep going the way I'm going?
Okay.
So these both were planted at the same time?
Yep.
Same source. One thing I'd tell you to look at is the trunk where it meets the roots, and see if you see a nice root flare on both of them. So does the place where the trunk and roots meet look the same on both of them? If you want to see a nice flared out zone at that point. And if you look at the one that's not doing good, you might not see a nice uniform flare zone around the entire trunk. You might see partial flare, which would indicate maybe a girdling root stressing it. Or if you don't see any flare, that could be that the tree was planted slightly too deep, and tree planted slightly too deep, you wouldn't think is a big deal, but it is. In the long run, it'll never do very well.
You're getting a lot of consistent dieback, and then you're getting new shoots off of the main trunk, and that's the recovery part? Is that how you...
Oh, we lost them.
Okay. Then, if that's happening, it's definitely something you might want to replace.
Yep.
All right. Over to Denise in Slingerlands. Denise, you're on.
Hi, I have a question about iris. I have some bearded iris that I transplanted from another house about 8 years ago, and they were doing great, and they needed to be divided. So, almost 3 years ago, and I divided them and put them back in the same place where they were, and I haven't seen a blossom since. What did I do wrong?
They're heavy feeders, and so the soil should have been amended, a lot of compost. This is one place where you can use a fair amount of phosphorus, so a fertilizer that contains phosphorus, very helpful. So the foliage is coming up, and it's just kind of okay.
Yeah, they're healthy, but they're just not good.
I would say phosphorus.
Is it getting a lot of shade?
It gets a little bit of morning sun and then mostly shade.
That would also affect it as well. The other spot you planted them from?
They bloomed fine when I first transplanted them.
Well, that first...
When they stopped blooming was after I divided them.
Yeah, that sometimes is common because it could be stressed. The original location where you had good luck, was it more sunny?
I think it was the same.
It's the same location.
Oh, okay.
At
okay.
the other house? No, at the other house it was about the same.
About the same.
And they've been blooming at this new house for about 5 years.
Okay. So
I would consider just starting over, like do another renovation just to be sure you don't have any borer issues in the tubers.
I was going to say that, too.
But then amend.
So take them out and replenish the soil and start over, sort
of? And I would wait till July again when they're...
Okay.
And check the little tubers to see if you see little holes. Those would be indicators of borer.
All right, Denise, thank you. Quickly over to Kate in Pittsfield. Kate, you're on.
Hi, I have questions about grubs, beetles, and peonies. We don't use any pesticides, and all of our neighbors do, so all the grubs go, and they come over to our yard. But every year, my husband plants the new grass, and every year we get huge bald spots. So I say, let's plant lavender or some perennial that's just going to grow and we'll have a flowering front yard. That's more beautiful than grass anyway. Are the grubs going to attack the lavender?
No.
Nope. You're safe with the other plants. The grubs are specifically feeding on turf roots. And there is a product that I would recommend you checking into. It's called Milky Spore Disease. And I know you don't want to spray anything. This is an organic type of fungus that you inoculate your lawn with, and it's its own little living ecosystem, and it only attacks the grubs, and it's Japanese beetle grubs specifically, and which are the ones that cause most of the damage. And it does take a couple of years to establish that milky spore disease in your lawn. It will not hurt anything. Just follow the recommendation, and then once you have gained some control, unlike your neighbors who have to apply all the time and nasty chemicals, you'll never have to reapply this product. It's a one-time deal.
All right, so, Kate, thank you very much. All right, we're just about out of time. Greg, how do we find Ward's Nursery on the World Wide Web?
Yeah, we're there, wardsnursery.com.
All right, and how about you there, Fred?
Yep, it's landisarboretum.org, and my email is fred@landisarboretum.org.
Well, that was a fast hour.
That was really fast quick. Hour.
And yeah. I apologize to the 9 people who are on hold who didn't get through here. So
we're so sorry. We're
big
very,
show.
Very sorry about that. Support for WAMC comes from Grapes and Grains Wine and Spirits, East Greenbush, New York, specializing in wine and craft spirits for more than 15 years, stocking single malts, bourbons, tequilas, and gins, grapesandgrainswine.com. Hadley Garden Center, Hadley, Massachusetts, offering annuals, perennials, vegetables, trees, and shrubs, indoor and outdoor plants, and information for landscapes and gardens, hadleygardencenter.com. Viva Fresh Pasta, 30 years and 30 wines by the glass, European cuisine infused with the flavors of the world, Northampton, Massachusetts. Grab life by the knife and fork, vivafreshpasta.com. And Stavros, helping people with disabilities achieve their dreams. Offices in Amherst, Greenfield, and Springfield. Stavros.org for more information. Thanks again to Greg Ward and Fred Breglia for being here. Thanks to you for listening and for all the great calls. And again, sorry to everybody who didn't make it through this time. Popular show, you know what I mean? Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Your phones were answered by Deb Malik. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, you know, it's Friday. And that means it's Food Friday. And tomorrow it's all about barbecue and grilling. And we'll welcome Jasper Alexander and Byron Nielsen to the show. That'll be fun. Bring your own bib. Stand by now for news.